Wendy called me a couple weeks ago and said, well, we're just getting close to finishing a series on miracles. And so I thought, okay, well, I can do a kind of a conclusion to miracles. And then I was looking at the former PowerPoints on this laptop here, and they were like, oh, Old Testament, another Old Testament, another Old Testament. And so you've been studying Old Testament miracles, correct? So far, nothing in the New Testament. So isn't that kind of interesting, based on my thinking, that when I think miracles, I think Jesus. Or perhaps Paul or some of the other apostles in the New Testament, when there was a lot of amazing miracles done by individuals in the Old Testament. Who have you studied? Okay, Daniel, Abraham, Moses, Joshua. Okay, and so those men, through God gave them some events that had some miracles that happened, and they were kind of the key proponent of that. And I know I've said this before here, but I'm going to say it again. And what spurred me for my love of the Old Testament was the passion that Clyde Johnston had for the Old Testament. He just loved it. He especially the Minor Prophets. And I remember when I first studied the Minor Prophets, I'm thinking like, how do you wade through these things? And I was a very young Christian at the time. But I think some of his passion, at least a little bit, came off on me, so I love the Old Testament. And I think that's a great study that you're doing, which we're not going to do one bit at all this morning. We're going to kind of jump to the New Testament and talk about the miracles of Jesus. Now, have you ever heard people say, you know, if only, or perhaps someone has said this, if only I had lived in the time of Jesus or the apostles, and I saw Peter walking on water, or Jesus walking on water, I saw people that were blind, we knew they were blind, they've been blind from birth and had sight. If I lived in those times, oh, I would be a believer, all right. I would be such a strong believer because I saw those miracles. Conversely, have you ever thought that perhaps someone in the first century could be making a conversation such as this that I'm about ready to describe? If only I had lived in the time of God's inspired word being completed and done, I could meditate on it. I could look at any epistle that Paul wrote, anything that was in the Gospels. Boy, if I could have all of those things at my fingertips as we do today, oh, then I would be a strong believer because it would be right here. You see, the excuse that sometimes people make. Robert?
You remember what Lazarus said to the rich man in Sheol? When the rich man said, send someone back.
Yeah.
For my brothers to be saved, not have to come here.
Yeah. And what was his response?
They
had the prophets. They had information that they could have looked at. And so, when we take that track, sometimes it can be a paradox that, you know, we have to live in the generation that we're a part of as Christians. Or the century that we are in. We can't change the time that we live in. In Acts chapter 17, in verse 26, I think it is, Paul talked about God giving people the habitation of their times. That's a very poor translation, or
I thought he was a translation. Could someone look at Acts 17:26, please, and raise your hand and if you'd like to read it out loud. I'm sure that's the verse, I just can't pull it out. Acts 17:26. Raise your hand if you've got it and you'd like to read it. Thank you, guys.
And he made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation.
Yeah. Okay, and so God has determined the appointed times that you and I are living in. He's determined the place that, and that kind of baffles our mind, doesn't it? Because we like to think, well, we're in charge of what we're doing. I can buy and sell property. I can go where I want to go. God determines things. And he has determined that we live in the 21st century where we have the completed word, and we can be thankful for that. Nothing is going to shake my faith in that. Now, let's jump just a little bit. I want to ask a question, and that is, what are human religions, like Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, what are some of those based on? That's kind of an open question, I realize, but what do they base their thinking on? Some man, isn't it? It's that man is going to find God somehow. And Christ is the opposite, isn't it? In Luke chapter 19 and verse 10, Jesus said, I came to seek and to save and find. Okay. And so with human religion, it's based on I got to find God. And I can find God through reincarnation. This deja vu experience that's very emotional, very comforting, because you don't have to do a whole lot. You can just kind of be who whatever you want to be. But a lot of it's kind of based on feelings. I had to look up Buddhism, because I thought all Buddhists just believe in reincarnation. Well, that's not the case. People that practice Hinduism are very much more involved with the idea of reincarnation. The world wants to say Christianity is the same way. That it's a lot of it's based on our belief system is based on feelings, emotions, and that's what has drawn us to Christ. That's a great tool of Satan, I think. That's how some people think that you're going to be drawn to God, and we would say no. It's based on our intellect. It's based on evidence. And miracles are proofs that lead that to eternal life. It's fact-based. I would assume that you would look at this verse, but you haven't because you're in the Old Testament. But in John chapter 20, John wrote and said, many other signs, therefore, Jesus performed in the presence of his disciples, which were not written in this book, but these have been written that you might believe. And so, that's what miracles were for. Miracles weren't for a circus sideshow. Miracles were to show that Jesus was everything he said he was. That he is the Son of God. And so he would make these great I am statements, especially in the book of John. Such as, I am the light. I am the way. What else in the book of John? I was just thinking, well, you would know all these because you studied this in your miracle class, but turns out we're going to have to go back to a John class from the archives of your brain. What else did Jesus say about
his truth?
I am the way and the truth and the life. Yeah. What else?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
John chapter 6 is where that's stated. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. Jesus said, I am the door. There's a woman at the well there in chapter 4. I am the good shepherd. And he lays down his life. And so there's so many I am statements that showing that he is God. And the miracles that he did proved that he was God. And that he was, because of that, we can believe. We can believe based on facts, not on emotion. And there's nothing wrong with emotion, by the way. Human emotion is a strong, attribute that God has given us. But it cannot be an engine of our faith. Thank you. I'm going to need some help with that.
All right, and so in John chapter 21, and I invite you to turn there. Open your Bibles to John chapter 21, or your phones to, or tablets to, whatever you use for finding John chapter 21. And this is the third appearance after his resurrection. And this section is going to answer the question. This question right here. And that is, what will the relationship be like after the resurrection? What will his relationship be with his apostles? What will it be with other believers? What's it going to be like? Because while he was on the earth, what was Jesus like to his apostles? Well, he was loving. He was nurturing. He was patient. And what did the apostles do? They left him. They deserted him. And they denied that they were his followers. Now Jesus comes back. He's Lord and he's Christ. And he's proved it by his miracles. And what's he going to be like? Vengeance? Wrathful? Angry? No. No. He's still going to be loving and caring. Now I want you to kind of soak that in a little bit of how Jesus relates to us. Because as he was, he is. He is a loving and caring God. Now, in other religions, people try to find God. Maybe they're looking to appease a God, an angry God. Or maybe they're looking for Nirvana, that's not a rock group, by the way, for some of you that would know that. Some of you are going, huh? I don't know what you're talking about. It's not like you're trying to find God, find Nirvana, find a place to appease God. It's that he loves and cares for you. And so, despite what's happened. I thought this would be a review, because for some reason I thought, okay, well, they did a miracle class. It's going to be on, they're probably going to cover, some things in the Gospels. They're probably going to talk about the book of John. Turns out it was all Old Testament. And so there were seven miracles in the book of John that Jesus did. And the first one was water to wine in chapter 2. Which shows that Jesus is the master over what? Yeah, I'm looking for a different word, but yeah, okay. Combine all those together and you'll take my word, which is master over quality. I like that. He takes water and he turns it to wine. And it was very good wine. It was like, what are you saving this for the end for? He healed the nobleman's son in chapter 4. And the interesting thing about that one was what? He wasn't even there. And the nobleman asked his servants, well, when did the son start feeling better? It was at the exact time that Jesus said, your son is healed. He's the master over distance. It doesn't make any difference where it was. Jesus didn't have to be there. And that's a pretty impressive miracle. He healed the lame man in chapter 5. Here I had you turn to John chapter 21 and really done much there yet. But we're just kind of perusing, kind of catching ourselves up here. What was amazing about this one in chapter 5? Everyone knew him. They knew he was lame. It wasn't like he was faking it. It happened in an absolute instant. It's no more than he went from wheelchair to crutches. How long was he a lame man? From birth, 38 years, and he instantly is healed. That's a pretty impressive miracle. Jesus is master over time. Fed the 5,000. Jesus, and this is a very common one that we know for some reason because it involves food. At least I kind of remember that one. You know, I'm driving down here. Who's going to invite me out afterwards? Do I take the first one? I've got to take the first one. Where are we going to go? What are we doing? Because I think about food. I do. And this morning, I'm a little foodie, okay? So, hey, there's a deal over at McDonald's. Oh, no. All right, can go. Feeding 5,000 people. Well, okay. I could be done at a big banquet. Somebody's getting married. Mickey, is it your daughter? Well, and Dean, where are you? Dean's teaching class. He's in with the 20 middle school kids. Five parents. Are you going to have 5,000 people at this wedding?
Nine.
Well, 500.
12.
12, yeah. Well, what's impressive about this miracle is what? Yeah, well, a couple baskets and a couple loaves of bread, and that was it. And he did 5,000. Master over quantity. And that's, again, very impressive. He walks on water in chapter 6. He's the master of physical law. He supersedes natural law. I always thought that. If I saw that, then I'd be a believer, strong believer. Well, wait a minute. I can read about it and what? Know that it was fact, and I can believe because of what Jesus, you see, what the miracles stand for. He renders sight in chapter 9, the picture there of the blind man, blind from birth, wasn't he? And his parents were kind of like, that's him, he's of age. You know, because they were a little bit not wanting to get in trouble with the authorities, the Jewish authorities. They didn't want to be put out of the synagogue. And again, what an impressive miracle that Jesus did. I think it's always good to review those, knowing that those are true events. Those help us to believe that Jesus is the Christ. That's what John chapter 20 and verses 30 and 31 are all about. And then, of course, his own death, burial, and resurrection. And the resurrection would be quite a miracle there. So, let's... Skip the resurrection of Lazarus. My bad. Let's go to John chapter 21. And could someone read just verse 1, please? Go ahead, Ron.
After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and on this wise. show of he himself.
Okay. The Sea of Tiberias, that's another name for the Sea of Galilee. Okay. Same place. And so we're getting to the epilogue. We're getting to the end. And there was quite initial success by the disciples through the gospel records. Yes? Yeah. Remember, they came back to Jesus and said, even the demons believe? But all of that just kind of unravels at the cross, doesn't it? And they're heartbroken. They can't believe this is the end of what happened. And so, verse 3, someone else read that one, please. You don't have to raise your hand. You can just read it. That was said. Read it, please. No. Okay, I'm not a fisherman. I don't have the patience for that. Scott Hafer. Remember, how many know Scott Hafer? He took me out fishing. And it really is fun because we're on the North Bay Dam and I got to keep all the fish that he mostly caught. And but it was nice. He taught me some things about fishing. Now, why does Peter decide to go fishing here at this time? That's what he does. He was a fisherman by trade. And so he says, you know what? I'm going to go fishing. Okay? And how'd the fishing go? Come back and brag about that one?
Fishing was good.
Catching was terrible. Yeah, okay. It got nothing. And that's kind of discouraging. You can just kind of imagine their disappointment as fishermen, professional, you know, as their trade, they get absolutely nothing. Someone read verse 4, please. Okay. Now, why did they not recognize Jesus? Okay.
They were far away.
The text doesn't say, does it? Maybe they were too far away. Maybe they weren't thinking about Jesus being there. Maybe they were prevented from seeing them. It doesn't say. So we can, you know, make all the guesses we want, but okay, they didn't recognize him. And in verse 5, someone read that, please. Okay. That's kind of humiliating to not have any fish as a professional, as your trade. They have nothing. And then Jesus instructs them in verse 6. You ever seen a fish finder before? The little on boats? You think I'm making that up? But isn't there a thing on a fish finder? Where you can kind of see a school of fish underneath and say, cut the engine right here. We're going to... Is that made up or is that real? Okay. My uncle fished and he had fish finders, so I kind of knew that. That was back in the 70s. That technology was around. And I love my uncle because it was a ski boat also. I mean, fishing or ski boat? Let's see. What am I going to do? We're going to go to Foster Reservoir. We're going to ski. Way off topic. But Jesus gives them instructions on how to fish. And these guys are the professionals. You think that would be kind of a struggle for them to take that. But here's what I want you to remember. He still cares for them. Even though they've denied him, he still cares. And in verse 7, what does John, the Apostle John, realize? This has to be Jesus. Because they're... So he's able to... he connects these dots so quickly. Why? This isn't the first rodeo that this has happened. Okay, in Luke chapter 5, the very same scenario was playing out.
where they were not catching any fish. Jesus told them to, here's how you do that. And they caught a bunch of fish. And here it happens again. And so John would say, it's the Lord. Which caused Peter to do what? Jump out of the boat. Did he think he could walk on water? Doesn't make any good, it doesn't say. But he runs to Jesus and leaves the rest of the people to deal with the 153 fish that they've got to bring in and get to shore. And so who's going to get there first? Well, Peter is, and he knows that. Okay, and so he wants to get to Jesus, and why? Because he loves him. He is so overjoyed to see him. And you know, impetuous Peter, he's, what, that's Jesus? I'm going. You got to take care of the fish. There's something more important than fish here. And so he jumps out of the boat and gets to Jesus first. Now, we often, let me back up here. I think we're still on this one. We often, when we remember Peter, what do we remember him for? The denial of Jesus, don't we? You know, I'll stand with you forever. And what did Jesus say? You're going to deny me three times. Before the cock crows, you're going to deny me. It's unfortunate. That's the Peter we remember. Because, and we're going to talk about this in our sermon today, we're going to see how Jesus got Peter to that place of what we can read about Peter in the book of Acts. Keep your finger there in John chapter 21, but flip over to Acts chapter 5.
Or move your phone, move your cursor, however you do that. Yeah. On the tablet to Acts chapter 5. Okay. Now I want you to notice the strength, the spiritual strength that Peter now has. In the chapter, where, for those of you that have read Acts recently, or perhaps you remember in the past, they were really just a beat up the apostles, throw them in jail, because they've been preaching Jesus, and we're not going to have that. Not in our city. No, no, no. Not in Jerusalem. But they're upsetting the whole town. And Gamaliel's advice is very sound. What is it? Yeah. You know what? There's been other people like that, and some come, they went to God, and then, but if they're really from God, Gamaliel says what? You're not going to chance. So let them be. Because they're going to either fail because they're just humans, or they're from God. And so someone start in and read 40, 41, and 42. Or you can nudge your neighbor and say, hey, you're reading that verse. 40, 41, and 42. Read that way.
And they agreed with him, and when they had called for the apostles, them, they commanded that they should not speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. So they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. And daily in the temple and in every house, they did not cease teaching and preaching Jesus as the Christ.
I'm very impressed by their fortitude to do that. And there's one word that sticks out to me in verse 41, and that is rejoicing. Here it is. They took their advice. Okay, we're just going to let them go. Oh no, we're not going to just let go scot-free. What happens to them? They get flogged. That doesn't sound very comforting. And tell them, you can't speak anymore about Jesus being the Christ. No more, not in this city. And the apostles, look at that, and they are rejoicing that, you know what? We're doing it for the right reason. And praise be to God for Peter's 180 degrees of where
where he was, where we left off in the end of the book of Matthew, when he was like, "Oh, I'm not one of them. Oh no, no, you got me confused. Now, I'm not a follower." You see the difference in Peter? And why is that the case? Because Jesus still loved him, still brought him along, still encouraged him. He can do that for us. You see the where I'm going with this? Yeah. And I look at my own life. Oh, I hate some spiritual failures. And sometimes I would think that God is merciful. God is compassionate. He's not saying, "All right, let's get this little book open on you, Jim. Look what you got up here. Check mark there. There's another will. Check mark there." Now, how many of you remember sitting in public school? And the teacher wrote the kid's name on the board because it was not bad. And then they put a check after him after that. Oh, ho, ho, ho. They did that to me. Put the old check on. You remember that? And if there was a check there, I was like, "And the double check! Oh, I'm shucking it out of that room. No mercy, no compassion. Maybe a 3-day suspension. Throw that in on top of that for that too. That's going to train them. How does that work out for those kids?" No, they really should sometimes. "Now, yeah, put another check on there." And they didn't graduate from that school high school. Jesus is not that way. He's compassionate. He's loving. He's nurturing. He cares. He cares for Peter. He brought him along. He cares for us. We've got a little bit more time. That's supposed to be the clincher in 10:06.
Okay. But we still have breakfast on the beach. I told you I like food, and so we can do this here. In back to chapter 21, starting in verse 9. It says, "So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Jesus said to them, 'Bring some of the fish which you have now caught.' Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land, full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, 'Come and have breakfast.' None of the disciples ventured to question him, 'Who are you?' knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead." All right, so here's the third story played out. He tells them how to fish. They catch large fish. Then they're going to go, and they're going to eat some fish together. And so, once again, though, it does prove that Jesus physically raised from the dead. He's not some vision. He's not some story that some Christians made up that he's still alive. No. He was an actual, there he is in human form on the beach cooking breakfast. And again, here's kind of our kicker. Even though they denied him earlier, he's still loving, he's still forgiving, and brethren, that's the Lord we serve. And as he invited them to eat, he invites us to come, and as it says in John chapter 6, to eat of him, to be a part of him. I want to close with a prayer that Paul said in Ephesians chapter 3. I know we've been talking about Peter, but the Apostle Paul had a
take a similar point on this. Ephesians chapter 3, let me start verse 13. It's interesting that when Paul starts giving instruction and he mentions the name Christ, he just automatically talks more about Christ. And he closes this section with a prayer. In Ephesians chapter 3, he says, "For this reason, I bow my knee before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend of all the saints what is the breadth and the length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ, which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled up to all through, excuse me, that you be filled up to all the fullness of God." I like that prayer that Paul says there. That we may know Christ. And that we may know him as a loving God. Not a vengeful God. Not a God that we have to appease. There are certain religions where we've got to appease these gods. We've got to make fun of them. Oh, you're going to throw the virgin into the volcano, so we'll beat it. Okay? We compromise and make it comical. There's nothing comical about what some people do to appease their God. And we can look at people in the Old Testament, some of the ites, where Joshua came in and took care of them. And they were called passing their children through fire. What's a nice name for what? You're murdered. You're sacrificing your own child to appease God. We look at that like, how twisted is that? That's not the kind of God that Jesus is. Look at him in verse 16. "That he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man." It's God working with us and helping us through, let's face it, there's some difficult times in our lives, isn't there? There is. We undergo what everybody else undergoes. It's not like, oh, we're immune to problems. No, we're going to have to. But God will be with us. God will help us. That should give us great comfort. Comments, please. Sarah.
One of the things that you just didn't happen to mention is that all of the witnesses who were his apostles who were sent out, that not only were they witnesses, but they had this miracle to prove that they were witnesses and his apostles sent out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not just that, okay, it's told in the Bible. It's a nice story, is what people say. But the same miracles still were verifying that what they were saying was true, that they were true.
Yeah. And how faith strengthening that is.
Kind of interesting to note here. I don't know why it just hit me, but in verse 18 there, you have the length, the height, and the depth, which are all physical dimensions.
Yeah.
And then we have the breadth, which is not physical. It covers some of the language, covers some of the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're the good with your hands with feet, don't you? Because you can make things. Yeah, if I was to go into a woodshop and make that, I'd be killing everybody. But you understand, okay, Lenny? Right? Yeah. But there's something beyond that. And that would be strengthened through the inner man. Not just the physical, that being that we are, that God can give us strength in any trial that comes. Now, at Towson, you can talk with brethren, and I hope you have formed relationships with someone that can encourage you along that path. It's your spouse, it should be. If it's a good friend, that's great. But that's some of the relation, one another relation, I guess you would say, that bring us closer to Christ. Anyone else?
Camellia's advice, somewhat sound. You mentioned Hinduism, Buddhism. Those works cannot be stopped either. And they're not the works of God.
Yeah.
He did well to quell the body.
Yeah, he was very wise in his words. People rebel against God. Well, it's going to be an unhappy thing. Anyone else?